This week's parsha is Tazria Metzora, page 608. Just before we start, just an interesting thing.
Morning. I'm just going to tell my husband that you're here.
Yeah, I mean. Just. It's Tazria Metzora. Interesting thing before we start, that is, it's a double parsha this week. It's one of these rare occurrences where our parsha this week is different to that in Israel. Israel has a different parsha this week. You know that. And it takes us a number of weeks to straighten out because the last day of Pesach was a Shabbos. But it wasn't the last day of Pesach in Israel. You realize, because they only have 7 days, right? And that happens sometimes. So what happened on the last day of Pesach is, because it's Yontif, we didn't read the parsha of the week. We always read a special parsha. But they went; they were finished Yontif, so they went to Shmini, right? And we only did Shmini last week. Last week they did Tazria Metzora. This week reading Tazria Metzora, they're doing Achrei Kedoshim, which is the next one. Now, it's interesting how the whole system works because in theory, we could have straightened up this week. What could have happened is they could have just separated the parsha. We could have caught up, but we don't do that for some reason. I'm not actually quite sure why. I've been trying to research it actually, but it's kind of they take the last up. They don't do that unless you have to, and they only do it. Not next week, they'll do it in a few weeks' time where we have two parshas, Bahara and Bechukosai, which are the last two parshas of Ayikra. They do Bahara the 1 week and they do Bechukosai the next week, and that's when we straighten out. So it's interesting. I've been in Israel actually, very interesting. I've been in Israel 1 year, it was after Shavuot, so the same thing happened with the Shavuot. And I was visiting Israel where, I think it was Chukat and Balak maybe, or Korach and Chukat, I'm not sure which one it was. But basically there was two different parshas, and when it came time for Torah reading, there were different minyanim, because there were so many visitors from Chutz Laaretz, so we made our own separate kriya. But interestingly enough, it wasn't done the way I thought it would be done. I thought we'd have a Chutz Laaretz, a diaspora minyan, just read our diaspora parsha, and they read the Israeli parsha. It's not done like that. Well, the way, anyway, maybe it's different customs. The way the shul I was at, the way they did it was that the diaspora parsha, because we were a week behind, they read for the first call up. They read the whole of the parsha, the Chutz Laaretz parsha, and the first call up of the Israeli parsha, and then did the Israeli parsha. I guess the idea is because you're in Israel, you can't just do a different parsha. But you've missed out a parsha, so you're behind, so therefore you do everything and you catch up. It's very interesting. Okay. So this week is Tazria and Metzora. So I'm just going to go through, if you have your handout there, I'll just go through an overview, quick overview. And then we'll highlight a couple of main things. So we have, at the beginning of the parsha, Tazria, we have the laws of childbirth, which also includes, for the second time in the Torah, the laws of bris, which is the circumcision. Then most of the parsha, in fact, most of the two parshas, deal with the laws of tzara'as, which I especially put it there in Hebrew, because we'll see later, the leprosy translation is actually not accurate. But it's the impurity, which is generated by this thing called tzara'as, which has to be always subject to the ruling of a kohen, as we'll soon see. There's all types of different tzara'as, even bodily ones. There's tzara'as that comes from a boil or a burn. There's tzara'as that can be on the head or the beard, and so on. And then we have all the laws of the mitzara. The mitzara is the noun, the person who has the tzara'as, his impurity and what he could do, or he or she could do and can't do. Then we have tzara'as of the garment. We know there's tzara'as of garments as well, and all the laws associated with that. Then in the second part of the parasha, which is the second parasha we read this week, we have the whole process of the purification of tzara'as. What a person has to do to become pure, it's a whole, when it heals up and the Kohen has to come and examine, he's got to bring all kinds of sacrifices and two birds and a whole story. Then also the parasha tells us about the tzara'as of the walls, which can also happen. Then at the end of the whole parasha, we have a section dealing with all kinds of bodily impurities, including finally also the purity and impurity of women, which is really the only one that's relevant today in terms, because today we don't really keep the laws of purity and impurity that much, because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. Because normally, the purity of all kinds of impurity is either through the red heifer, if it's about coming into contact with the dead body, or it's through a mikveh, right? Which, in temple times, purity and impurity was an incredibly relevant halacha. It was like laws of Shabbos today. I mean, you had to study it properly, because you had to know when you're impure, and how you become pure. Because you certain things you couldn't eat if you were impure. You couldn't go to the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, if you were impure. All kinds of things, right? And there were different customs. There were certain people who were not careful about the laws of purity and impurity unless they had to be. And then there were certain people who were careful always to live in purity, which made it even more complicated, because it's actually one of the most complex parts of the halachic law, purity and impurity. But today, more than any time, it's much more complicated because it's all abstract. In fact, the section of Mishnais, which deals with it, is one of the most difficult sections of Mishnah. Partly because also it's difficult to understand what they're talking about. They talk about all different kinds of vessels and ovens and utensils and things, which you have to work out what they're talking about, because we don't have the same vessels and utensils today. So it's quite complicated. The only main, there's a few others, but the only main relevance of purity and impurity today is in terms of, I'm going to mikveh, is the woman. Because that's still relevant, and the Torah prohibits relations between man and woman if she's in menstruation. And therefore that becomes relevant, and that's also in this week's parsha, towards the end of the parsha, in terms of mikveh and so on. Okay, that's that. So let's have a look at a couple of different things. First, let's have a look a little bit at the... Sorry, I came late and rushed into the shiur and I've got my notes. Give me 1 second, sorry. Not like this, and we're going to talk about this. Will come be evident when we talk about it a bit later on, because the whole purity and impurity is a very abstract thing, and it all falls into really the concept of chukim. I mean, we have explanations, and we've done it in previous years about how purity is impurity is created through a vacuum of holiness and so on and so forth. When there's life and there's absence of life, there's impurity, which is why we have in the beginning of the parasha we have the laws of childbirth and a woman becomes impure and so forth. But that's. We have general explanations, but we really don't know what becomes pure and why things become pure or impure. It's very abstract, very spiritual, and we don't really have a hold on it. So, yes, it does have to do with toiling of Kalim. It's very similar. There's some lack of holiness, probably is a better word to say, when there's some upgrade of holiness that a vessel requires when it comes into the hands of a Jew from a non-Jew. And therefore, before you can use it, it needs to be toiled.
Same. It's going to come in contact with.
If it's going to come in contact with food, yep. Correct. If you're going to use food, yeah. But that's a detail in all the laws of purity and impurity, which are also relevant today, correct. Okay. Because essentially, a mikveh is a transformation process. Water is a transforming ingredient, yeah. That's why that also happens through water, through a mikveh. The laws of mikveh are the same, it's got to be a kosher mikveh that you immerse vessels in. Yeah. It can't be any water. Okay, so let's have a look at a little bit of the first part of the parasha, where the Torah introduces the laws of childbirth. So, by Dabar Hashem Moshe Lehem, that's page 608. Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, saying, Dabar El Bnei Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people, Lehem are saying, Isha Ki Sazriya V'yol Dezachar, a woman who conceives and gives birth to a male, the Toma Shivas Yomim, she shall become automatically impure for 7 days, Kamei nidas to voice satitma, and the impurity she experiences is similar to the impurity that a woman experiences when she menstruates, when she's a nida. Then the Torah says, "Vayoyim hashmini, on the 8th day, yimol b'sar or losoi, should undergo circumcision." Then there's a further period of 33 days, which is a shloishim yoyim, a shloishes yomim, for 33 days, teisha b'dmei tahara, she should sit in a period of purity, meaning she's impure, but her blood is pure. That's what it means to say. In other words, she doesn't have the laws of menstruation for those 33 days. However, it's like an in-between period. It's after the 7 days. B'chol kodesh le'sigah, she can't touch anything that's holy, meaning sacrifices. Vela migdosh le'sovoy, she cannot come to the temple. Ad melo simei tohara, until the days of purification have ended. When they do end, after the 40 days, she goes to mikveh, she has certain sacrifices, and then she's pure again. For a girl, it's double the time, and that's the laws of impurity that comes from childbirth. But I want to just pick up, we've talked about in previous years about how that works and why she's impure and all that, but I want to just touch on the instruction of circumcision here, and just to share with you an interesting concept. The Torah, we know the mitzvah of Bris Milah takes place all the way at the beginning of the Chumash in Parshas Lech Lecha, right? Here, the Torah repeats it, and there's many reasons why it's repeated. One of the things that happens is that we learn from this pasuk, right? that it said Ubayoim Hashmini on the eighth day, and it's an extra pasuk because we don't need it because we've already had it in the Torah before. He should have a circumcision. One of the things we learn is that on the eighth day, a child always has a bris, even if it's Shabbos. Right? Which we know that if a bris is on time, and it's the eighth day, and a baby isn't born naturally, and so on, therefore, the bris takes place on Shabbos, even though the bris involves many Shabbos transgressions. So I saw an interesting halachic question. I'll just share with you because I thought it was just interesting. We know that there are many mitzvahs that we do even on Shabbos, and yet some of them, the rabbis stopped us from doing, which they can do, if it's Shabbos. For example, a typical example that's always brought is shofar. It's a mitzvah to blow shofar on the first day of Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, right? Nowadays, if Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar. Why don't we blow the shofar? It originates with a decree that was made by the rabbis, instituted by the rabbis as a fence around Shabbos desecration. And it was called Shema Yavirenu. The rabbis were worried that if someone has to blow shofar on Shabbos, and everyone knows how to blow, everyone is obligated in the blowing of the shofar, but yet not everyone knows how to blow the shofar, so they're worried that people would carry the shofar in the street, in the public domain, which if there's a public domain on Shabbos, carrying it in the street is a desecration of Shabbos, and therefore they stopped us from doing the mitzvah of shofar. How can they do that? That's a complicated story, but the bottom line is that they can. The rabbis have a mandate, they can even stop us sometimes from doing a mitzvah in order to prevent more severe desecration. They have that mandate, they have that halachic ability. Okay. Same thing when the first day of Sukkot comes out on Shabbos. We don't shake a lulav. Right? Same thing because you have to know how all the halachas, we had to shave it, how to shake it, how to wave it. Therefore they were worried that you take it to someone to learn, and therefore it will work. So the question is asked, how come we don't have such a similar rabbinic decree about a baby being born on Shabbos and the eighth day coming on Shabbos, that we shouldn't do the bris because maybe they'll either carry the baby, or not the baby, maybe they'll carry the knife. Right? There's a baby. There's two parts to a bris. There's a baby and there's the instruments. One of them have to meet somewhere, right? So one of them has to be carried. But normally the way we do it today is we carry before Shabbos if there's no eruv. But that's why, I mean, nowadays there's eruv, but pre-Eruv or places that aren't Eruv, most brises on Shabbos are not done in shul. During the week, some brises are done in shul, some brises aren't done in shul, but on Shabbos they're never done in shul because baby's at home. So you can't carry the baby. So therefore normally what the mohel does, it brings it before Shabbos and they do the bris in the house on Shabbos, right? But why don't we have the same decree of not doing the bris on Shabbos in case you come to carry it? In fact, if you think about it, there's today especially there'd be more chances of carrying when it comes to a bris, you know, the moel forgot his knife or whatever the case is, than a shofar. I mean, shofar now is very established, you do it in shul, there's always a shofar in shul, the rabbi's been practicing a whole elul blowing the shofar in, it's not like there's such a big deal, but there'd be more chances by a bris, so why don't we find the same decree? One suggestion that's brought is perhaps because a bris is always done by an expert, and therefore the expert is normally knowledgeable. But that doesn't really answer the question fully, because that only answers that if the bris is being done where the knife is. He won't carry the knife. But the baby might be carried. But the answer actually is quite a simple answer. And I'll tell you why I'm bringing this in, because it's actually related to something we just had. The answer that's brought is very simple. See, shofar, let's take the mitzvah shofar, right? The mitzvah shofar is to blow every Rosh Hashanah, you've got to blow shofar. The Torah says, blow shofar every Rosh Hashanah, which means Shabbos, because the truth is, we don't need a special pasuk to tell us that we can do it on Shabbos, because biblically blowing the shofar doesn't actually involve a Shabbos desecration. It involves a rabbinic Shabbos desecration, but not a biblical. To blow shofar, to play an instrument on Shabbos is not biblically violating Shabbos, right? It's only rabbinic, which the rabbis enforced even on Rosh Hashanah, and therefore they said you couldn't do it. So Rosh Hashanah is a mitzvah to blow shofar. There's no mitzvah to blow shofar on Shabbos. There's a mitzvah that is general, just to blow shofar every Rosh Hashanah. Comes Rosh Hashanah, that's on Shabbos, and the rabbis say, okay, this time I don't want you to blow shofar, this year is an exception, because you might come to carry. When it comes to bris, they can't do that. Why not? Because the Torah specially gave a special pasuk in our parasha, telling us that you're allowed to blow shofar on Shabbos. That you're allowed to do the bris on Shabbos, sorry. Right? So for the rabbis that come along and say you can't do the bris on Shabbos, wouldn't be just saying you can always do something a bris, but just you can't do it when it's on Shabbos. They would be uprooting an entire mitzvah in the Torah. That they can't do. There's a specific command in this week's parasha to do a bris on Shabbos. Apart from the general bris mitzvah. And therefore, because there's a specific instruction to do it on Shabbos, they don't have the halachic power to prevent it happening on Shabbos. But I just brought it in, I want to take it just one step further. Because actually, you can take this whole thing a little bit on a deeper level. A similar question is asked, which doesn't have the same answer, on Pesach. This year we had an interesting Pesach. We had the first day of Pesach on Shabbos. Right? So the question is asked, how come there's no similar decree? There's all kinds of halachas related to the measurements of the cup, of how much you have to have wine, how much matzah you have to eat. There's lots of different halachas that are related. Right? Why aren't we worried that there's so many different halachas on Pesach night that someone's going to forget exactly how much wine he has to drink, or he's not sure if his cup is big enough? He might take it to the rabbi to show him, is my cup big enough? Do I have enough wine yet? I mean, there's lots of halachas, right? Just as it is by shofar and melilla. What's the difference? So how come there's no decree? The question is also asked, how come there's no decree with Pesach that falls on Shabbos? Maybe we shouldn't eat matzah or drink 4 cups of wine. Right? And then you don't have the same answers we give, because you can't say there's a specific pasuk, because there isn't. There's no specific pasuk to because there's no Shabbos violation really, so therefore there's no specific pasuk, so why don't we have the same problem? So one of the general answers is like this, and I think we've shared this idea before, that when the rabbis prevent us from doing a mitzvah on a Shabbos because of a halachic reason, it's not the entire reason. Because at the end of the day, if you think about it, the Torah operates on many levels, right? But if you think about it, just to say that the whole of Klal Yisrael should not blow shofar because one guy might forget and carry the shofar in the street, it's a little far-fetched. I mean, mitzvahs of shofar is such an important mitzvah. But as we explained before, the way it works is like this. The Torah operates on many levels. What actually happens, and now's not the time to go into why, but what actually happens is that when Rosh Hashanah falls out on a Shabbos, what shofar can spiritually accomplish is already sort of accomplished by Shabbos. In other words, spiritually speaking, when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, you don't need the shofar that much. That's how it starts. But that's not halachic terminology. You can't base halacha on that kind of thing. So what happens is, it evolves into the world of halacha. In the world of halacha, because there exists a problem that someone might come to carry on Shabbos, that's a halachic reason to prevent you to do a mitzvah, and therefore translates into that halachic process of saying, don't blow the shofar, because someone might come to carry it. But that's not the entire reason. The reason that they came to that reason, Kabbalistically, is because it's backed up by a deeper reason. It's backed up by a deeper reason that, in fact, you don't need the shofar that much when it comes on Shabbos, because Shabbos accomplishes what shofar could accomplish. And that needs a whole other shiur to explain why. Which explains why in Pesach didn't make that decree. Because obviously with Pesach it's not the same. Pesach, the Shabbos, doesn't accomplish what matzah accomplishes, or what our 4 cups accomplish, and therefore you can't make that decree. And perhaps on a deeper level, it's the same thing when it comes to bris. And with bris, we can understand it 100%. Because there's a whole spiritual reason why the bris overrides Shabbos. Why? Because the bris is taka higher than Shabbos. Shabbos is number 7. It's the perfect, the perfection of nature. Whereas bris represents the supernatural connection, the number 8, which is transcendent number of our connection to Hashem. And therefore, of course, you can't make such a thing, don't do it on Shabbos, because Shabbos doesn't accomplish the same thing as bris. Bris is much higher than Shabbos. And that's why they couldn't make that decree. So it kind of all fits in, and it's just connected to this Pesach we just had, which is also, we do the mitzvahs notwithstanding that it's Shabbos. Okay. Now I want to go into the next part of the parasha, which is the concept of tzaras, and just give a bit of a general overview in it, and then go into something very specific. Let's have a look. It's the bottom of page 608. So the Torah says, "Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe vel Aaron leimer, Adam." Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron. Adam, a man, ki yihye b'or b'sore, who will have on his flesh se'es oy sapachas oy baheres. These are all terms for tzaras. V'hoyo b'or b'sore l'negat tzaras, and they will develop on his skin as a plague of tzaras. V'huvo el Aaron ha'kohen, he will be brought to Aaron the Kohen, oy el achad mibonav ha'kohenim, or to one of the sons will be kohen. So what happens then? What happens like this. The person develops what he thinks might be tzaras. The halacha is he must go, or she must go, to the kohen. Only a kohen can rule tzaras or not tzaras. Sometimes there's a whole process. There's all kinds of halachas. The kohen has to quarantine the man for a while. and see what happens during the week. If during the week it develops or decreases or stays the same, that will determine if it becomes pure. And at the end of the process, the Kohen will declare this person is Tomei or this person is Toher, pure or impure. If it happens, it's all kinds of halachas. The person has to sit isolation and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, a couple of different thoughts about tzaraas. First of all, what is tzaraas? As we said, tzaraas is not leprosy. Leprosy is a physiological disease that still exists today in some parts of the world, unfortunately. But that's not tzaraas. And the Mefarshim, the commentaries are very, very clear about this. Right? The Rambam says that, in fact, tzaraas is a collective term for many different diseases that actually are not connected with each other. Because if you look through the parasha, you see there's all kinds of different things that can happen to the body, which have nothing to do with each other. It can be raw skin, it can be white scab, it can be all kinds of different things. It can be on a clothing, it can be on a wall, and they're all very different colors and everything, and yet they're all called tzaraas. Because it's all part of one, as what the Rambam says, one supernatural disease that happens to someone, which is a miraculous thing. It obviously has physical symptoms, but yet it is by nature a spiritual, supernatural disease that happens to people as a punishment and brings a certain type of impurity. Right?
So the second the temple was
destroyed, it disappeared. Might have even stopped, from memory, I don't remember. I think the Gemara said it might have even stopped before the end of the destruction of the temple.
How come?
Because we'll soon see in a second. Why does it happen? So the classic concept of why it happens is because of the sin of Lashon Hara. So the person that speaks Lashon Hara or slanders other people, that's a terrible thing, and therefore if it fits into the laws of Lashon Hara, I mean, there's permissible Lashon Hara sometimes, but this is obviously a person talks prohibited Lashon Hara, and as a result, he's given that impurity. It could be also things which are related to between man and man, like not giving tzedakah or not helping other people. One of the things that is pointed out by the Mefarshim is one of the tzaraas is the tzaraas of the walls. And sometimes what happens is when the tzaraas of the walls, and a guy goes to the Kohen, he says, I think I don't know, something funny happening on my wall, it might be a tzaraas. So the Kohen says, I'm going to come and examine it, but before I get there, take out all the vessels from the room, because if I come and declare tzaraas, everything in the house will become impure. So take everything out to the street. And the Mefarshim explained what happens is, sometimes that was a punishment. That was a person who had a lot of resources and refused to help anyone out. Because every time someone would come to say, can I borrow, I don't know, you have an extra pan, frying pan, he says, I don't have any, I'm sorry. Right? So what does Hashem do? He brings me tzaraas, so I've got to take everything out of the house, and everyone can walk by and see on this, he's got a dozen frying pans. You know, so that's like a kind of also. Okay. The Rambam also says what happens is, although in the Torah it's the opposite order, but often what happens is that first tzaraas will develop on the walls of the house, and as a warning, if the person does tshuva, it will disappear and the house will not be declared impure. If he doesn't do tshuva, the house will have to be demolished. If that still doesn't help, the tzaraas will develop on his clothing, and ultimately the tzaraas develops on his body, which is the most severe form of all tzaraas. So the concept, of course, that we need to understand is, why don't we have tzaraas today? Probably a great thing that we don't have it today, but why don't we have it today? So the Mefarshim point out, and the Alshit talks about it, highlighting something else which is interesting. Have a look at the pasuk we just learned. Right. It says, Adam ki hiyeh ba'or basari, a man, right? Now there's different phrases in the Torah that refers to a human being. Normally they symbolize different levels of a human being. The highest level of a person is Adam. Right? So Adam, the word Adam, is a reference to a person who's on a high level. Because the word Adam comes from Adame le'elyon, to be similar to above. Right? So that in itself is a question. How come when the Torah talks about the plague of tzaraas, it refers to an Adam? What kind of Adam is this? A person who talks Lashon Hara, a person involved in bad behavior between man and man, and so on and so forth. Right? And the answer is as follows. The answer is, that's why we don't have tzaraas today. Tzaraas was only given to a person who was on a higher level. Okay? And in fact, Kabbalistically, they explain that it's also represented by this concept that it's in the form of a skin disease. The fact that it's formed a skin disease is that it's external. Tzaraas was given, and it was an extra strict measure taken with someone who actually is fine, a person who's completely okay, a person who's pure. He's called an Adam, he's on a higher level. He has some external impurities. In other words, he's not perfect. And even according to the Rambam, when he talks about the Lashon Hara, that the person got tzaraas spoke, we're not talking about bad forms of Lashon Hara, we're talking about minor infractions of Lashon Hara. Things which are relative to severe Lashon Hara, sort of external rather than internal. They're not part of him, not part of his identity. It's not a person who's a Lashon Hara guy. It's a person who he didn't speak appropriately and it by no way resembles his internal identity. That's the person that gets tzaras. So on a deeper level, the fact that we don't have tzaras today is because we don't, it's funny to say that we don't deserve tzaras today in a way. Because we're not on that level to be able to have that tzaras. We've got much bigger problems. Right, so therefore we're at a lower level, and that's hinted in the fact that the Pasuk, when it talks about tzaras, talks specifically about an Adam and not anyone else, because that's the person who gets tzaras and no one else. Before I go on to what I really want to talk about, I just want to share with you a very cute idea that I saw on this parasha. It says that he has to come to the Kohen. So why a Kohen? So different. One reason I want to explain to you is because a Kohen we know is the man of Chesed. We know that the Kohen represents Chesed and Levi represents Gvura. So Aaron HaKohen was the ultimate Chesed. He always make peace between people and so on and so forth. Right? So what does this person have to do? A Kohen has to declare a person Tameh. He has to be able to identify a disease, identify an impurity. So the Torah is teaching us an interesting lesson here. That who has a right to identify an impurity on someone else only if you have pure Chesed. If you look at other person with pure Chesed, then you have a right to criticize, then you have a right to identify Chesed. Who can make the person Tomei? Who can make the person impure? Only a Kohen. Not someone else. That's the, one of the lessons. Okay, I think we've shared that in other years. But I saw this here, a very beautiful idea. And it was an idea said in a story. It was from a Rebbe called Reb Osher of Stolin. Osher Stolin was a Hasidic Rebbe. And he was a Chassid himself. He was a disciple of a great Chassid Rebbe, a very, very Chassid Rebbe, known as Reb Shlomo of Karlin. So this Reb Osher of Stolin, he was once talking to his Chassidim and he was reprimanding them. And he was trying to explain to them how a relationship between a Chassid and a Rebbe is supposed to take place. What's the idea of a Chassid between a Chassid and a Rebbe? A Chassid Rebbe is a Chassid as a Rebbe. And he goes to him to guide him, to inspire him, to help him improve and so on and so forth. So he says, he once told his Chassidim, he said, you've got a problem. He was reprimanding them. He said, let me explain to you what your problem is. And he quoted this passage. He said, what are we reading? What we read in the passage? It says, a person who develops tzaras, he has a disease, he has an impurity, he goes to the Kohen. He says, you know what the problem with you guys are? He says, when you come to the Rebbe, you only show your good side. You come and kind of, you know, show what you've done well, what you did. And your bad side, you're hard. You don't show your negative side to the Rebbe because you're embarrassed, right? He said, you got it all wrong. He said, when we would go to our Rebbe, he said, when he would go to Reb Shlomo of Karlin, he said, we did it the opposite way around. We would only show our bad side, we never show our good side. Why? What does he show our good side for? What's he going to do with that good side? He's going to reward us? He's not God. What's he going to do with that good side? We came to him and said, he should help us improve. So we showed him our bad side. And he said, that's what the Pasuk says. When you have a tzaras, when you have a the Kohen in this case is like the symbol of the tzaddik, right? He says, when you have a negative thing, the huva la Kohen, that's when you go to the Kohen. Don't show him what kind of tzaddik you are, show him your problems so he can help you improve. It's a very nice twist. And he said, when I saw this chat, he brings another thing. He said, this explains an interesting Gemara, which on the surface means something completely different, but it's interesting. He says like this. He says, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, and he said, you know, all my life I tried to serve my father. His father was also a great sage and so on. But he said, I didn't serve him like Esav. Esav served his father different. Why? He says, because when I would serve my father, I would serve him with dirty clothing. Right? But when I would travel, go out of the house, and I put on my nice clothing. Right? Esav, you know, one of Esav's strengths, even though he was Esav, he was a kibbutz avim, he honored his father very much. Esav, when he would serve his father, he would serve it with beautiful clothing. What's the simple pshat of the Gemara? The simple meaning of the Gemara is that he was bimon. He said, I was a great guy. I did try to do kibbutz av, I tried to honor my father, but I didn't make it to the level of Esav. Why? Because when I had to clean my father or help him out with fix the bathroom, so obviously I put on overalls, I don't dirty myself. When I go out to the house, I put on nice clothing. Esau, whenever he would help his father, he put on his best clothing because that was part of the mitzvah. Interesting, itself an interesting insight. But he said, no, according to the story, he said the pshat is different. What he was saying is that he had a very big difference to Esau. He said, when I served my father, meaning when I went to my father for advice, I wore my dirty clothes. I showed him my bad side. I know, he says, it's a problem on the one hand, because the problem, maybe he was disturbed, the fact that I have a bad side, but I had to show my bad side because that's the only way I could improve. Esau didn't do that. Esau, when he went to his father, he put on his grave clothes. Why? As we know, that's the whole thing of Esau. Esau used to trick Yitzchak. He used to say, how do you do this halacha? How do you do that halacha? He wanted to trick him into it. So what do you do? He wore his best clothes. That's what Esau does. He says, the same thing with you guys. You go to the kohen, you're supposed to show him your tzaras. You don't go to the kohen to show him your greatness. You go to the kohen when you have tzaras, when you have impurity, so he can help you out. That's how you have to go. Interesting angle on seeking good advice or good leadership or whatever the case is. Actually, interesting enough, it wouldn't be complete if I don't finish it. Interesting enough, it's not always that way. The Baba Cherebbe once wrote my father a very, very sharp letter. And subsequently I saw many, many people who wrote a similar concept to. My father moved to Cape Town, whatever, after he was married. So the Rebbe asked him to keep in touch. Like, you should write to him, tell him how he's doing, etc., etc. He didn't feel want to bother the Rebbe, whatever the case is. And the Rebbe used to often. And one time the Rebbe actually got a little bit upset, you could say. And he wrote to him about something, and he said, it's like, he wrote on the side, actually saw it. He wrote on the side, like his handwriting, like, I've asked so many times to write, what's going on here? I must say, exclamation mark, oh. But why? Because the Rebbe had a little bit of a different view than this. I'm saying, both things are true. I brought him before, because it's interesting, but. But the Rebbe held that as a relationship between a chassid and the Rebbe, you need to show both sides. Because that's how you stay connected. He used to always complain, in the name of his father-in-law, he didn't want what he called tsaras chassidim. He said, chassidim coming to him only when things go bad. Recently I saw an amazing clip of a dollar, that the Rebbe's thinking about dollars on Sunday. And a guy comes to, Rebbe used to complain, that people only come when they got bad news. I want to know the good news also, like that he worried about them, so he wanted to know that good side as well. So a person came to Dollars, and it's an interesting clip, I saw it recently. And he comes to the Rebbe and he says, I just wanted to know, I was here a year or two ago, and my wife and I didn't have children for a long time. I asked you for a bracha, and I'm pleased to let you know. So I'm coming now just to let you know, not to ask for a blessing, but to let you know that we had a son. So, thank you. So he said to the Rebbe. So the Rebbe gives him an extra dollar, and he says to him, thank you very much for informing me for the good news. Many people are not doing so. And it was like they were saying, thanks for doing this, because a lot of people don't do this. Like, it's an interesting concept. Like, they ask for a bracha when things are going bad. People write to the devil when it's going bad. But when things go well, why don't you say the good news? Like, why don't you tell the good news? And the same thing is spiritual. We very often like to know about good things people have done. Yes, come to me with your problems, your spiritual problems, your physical problems. But at the same time, let him know. But it's on a different level. It's not because you want to brag. It's because you want him to be happy. So that's a different concept. Okay. Just thought I'd bring that in. All right. What I want to do now for the rest of the year is, like we sometimes do, is pick up on a very small detail of this whole thing with Saras and learn a Mishnah with you, and then explain the Mishnah on a whole deeper level with a very fascinating concept. Let me show you where it is. If you go to hold on.
So I just ask you, can a kohen get Saras?
Yeah, sure, you have to go to a different kohen. Yeah. You have to go to somewhere, yeah. In fact, that's an interesting thing you mentioned. There's a Mishnah that says a Kohen can look at everyone's diseases except for his own. He can't look at his own. So that's, on a simple level, that's just about tzaras. That if a Kohen gets tzaras, he can look at anyone else's tzaras, but he can't look at his own tzaras. He can't examine and determine his own tzaras. On a deeper level, it means you can identify other people's faults, but a person can never identify his own faults. He needs someone else to do that.
So you have to go to like a higher
Kohen? No, different Kohen. That's be someone else. That's the idea. Okay, go to page 616, where the Torah discusses the halachas of the person who has tzaras. Okay, and the pasuk says the following: If you look at pasuk Mem Zayin, right? So the pasuk says 47. Yeah. Sorry, 46, I'm sorry. Pasuk says, Kol yamei asher hanega bo yitzma tome. Cool. As long as he has the tzaras, he has his disease, he is tome, is impure. Bodod yeshev, he has to sit alone. That's part of the punishment of the person with leprosy, to sit in isolation, not to contaminate other people. Michutz la machane, outside of the camp, Moishavoi should be his dwelling, which means he's got to like quarantine, he's got to live outside everywhere else. Okay. But In Torah Shabbat Peh, in the Oral Torah, there's something learned from the word Moishavoi, his dwelling place. He must sit outside, must be his dwelling place. That what? We learn an interesting thing about the Metzora, about the person who has Tzaras. That when he dwells somewhere, if the Tzaras walks into the person who has Tzaras, if he's in the same room as other utensils, everything in that room will become contaminated, will become tameh, will be impure, and will require purification. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. So you look in your handout, there's a Mishnah. Right? And the Mishnah deals with this issue. Since we learn this halacha via Torah Shabbat Peh, that a Metzora, someone who has Tzaras, walks into a room or walks to a house, everything in that house will become tameh. So what happens if he walks into someone else's house? He's got Tzaras and he walks into someone else's house. What's going to happen with all the utensils in that house? Says the Mishnah, Metzora shenichnas labais, a Metzora who went into a house. Right, you have that Mishnah at the bottom of the page, yeah? Kol hakelim sheyesh sham tmei. All the utensils, all the vessels in that house become impure. When do they become impure? Says the Mishnah. The Mishnah goes into some other things, and at the end of the Mishnah comes like this. Kalim, there's two opinions. The vessels in the house, the utensils, miyad etzmei, will become tomei immediately, as soon as the Metzora is there. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, no. That's only if he stays there for a certain amount of time. What's the amount of time? In shoha kedei hadlokas haner. If he stays in the house, the time it would take a person to light a candle, and he's still in the house, he hasn't left yet, then everything in the house will become tomei, become impure. If however he walks into the house and immediately leaves before the time it would take someone to light a candle, then everything in the house is safe.
Lighting a candle takes a second.
Okay. Maybe, so I have to say, whatever it is. Second, 2 seconds. No, in those days it didn't take a second, it took a longer because it's a bit messy, but okay, 3 seconds, that's it. Now, let me explain to you first on halachic level what's going on. The Mefarshim explain that it all depends. What Rabbi Yehuda is saying is as follows. Because what happened here, according to the commentaries, is that the person went into the house with not against the will of the owner. It was, he didn't have permission to go in. Right? So what the Mishnah, what Rabbi Yehuda is saying is like this. You can't say, if someone comes to the house with Tzaras, against my will, I need time to tell him to get out. So he says the Torah gave a certain time frame. In other words, if I wait a couple of seconds and I could have told him to leave and I don't tell him to leave, then it means that I can't have given permission. If I can't have given permission, then we can call this house his dwelling place, not just my dwelling place, because you're here with permission. As soon as you're here with permission, it becomes your house. And the Torah teaches us whatever's in your house becomes Tomei. However, if the guy leaves before I had a chance, or less than the time that it would take me to tell him to leave, you can't conclude that it became his house, and therefore it's not his house yet, and therefore everything is protected. Okay? That's it. Okay. However, everything in Torah is exact. Right? So even though on a halachic level, all that we're saying is that a person, according to Rabbi Yehuda, if a person moves into a house, walks into a house, he has Tzaras, he has a couple of seconds before everything becomes Tomei. What is a couple of seconds? The time it takes for the owner to tell the person to leave. Okay, that's fine, that's understandable. But the example that was given by the Mishnah is the time it takes to light a candle. What does that mean? So I'm going to explain to you on two levels according to what's explained in different places. And it's very interesting, fascinating idea. Different things in the world represent different parts of our personality or different levels of spirituality, right? Now, we've talked about many, many times, you know, we have the idea of Chochma, Bina, Das, etc., etc., right? Like we know that water represents Chesed, fire represents Gvura, all these different types of things, right? In levels of spirituality, a house, talking about going into a house here, right? A house represents the concept of Malchus. What is Malchus? So we've talked about this before, but just very, very briefly. from when you get to a implement something, there's a journey. Starts off intellectually, then has to be emotionally, then you implement it and so on, right? We know that when you actually implement something, so from when you have an idea, when you conceive an idea, right, until you actually implement it, the implementation stage is called malchus, leadership. Often we translate that 10th level as implementation, malchus, right? But when we behave a certain way, or we communicate a certain way, or we speak a certain way, what's that driven by? In other words, what is a house? A house is four walls, it's a room, that's what it is, right? The beauty of the house all depends on what's in it, correct? Same thing. Behavior is an action. What determines if the action is good or bad, holy or unholy, pure or impure? It depends what's driving the action, what's behind the action. What's behind the action is all the 10 levels of personality that come before the level of malchus. What's the first level? First level is chokhmah. Okay. What's chokhmah? We've talked about this many times. The beginning of a journey of any process is when you conceive an idea. But in conception of an idea itself, there's two levels. One is chokhmah, one is binah. Binah is when I understand it very well. Chokhmah is the kernel of truth, the flash, the revelation, the conception of the idea, the very foundation of the idea. In fact, the way Hasidic philosophy or Kabbalah explains the idea of Chachmah, Chachmah is more, not so much me understanding, Chachmah is more my submission to an idea from the outside. I'm going a bit quickly, so if you lose me, tell me. Okay? In other words, I need a solution to a problem, I need to clarity, I need to understand how to do something properly. To have real Chachmah means to be open to something different, that's not my idea. Something that I wasn't able to think of in my own limited context. An idea flashes through my head that comes from the Torah, or comes from a truth, whatever the case is. I grab that kernel of truth. I then process it to try and understand it properly. I then internalize it, which is Das. I then build an emotion attached to it, to feel, to get passionate, excited, and I then implement it. Right? So what is Chokhmah? Chokhmah is that truth that is detached, it's aloof, it comes from somewhere else. It's like a spiritual thing, a spiritual flash of truth that is guiding me, right? The danger is, often we know, that when we... And that's why it's clarity. You know that chokhmah is always comes with clarity. You know, like when you have a real problem, right? And suddenly, you get it. What's that moment? It's a moment of truth. What is it also a moment of? A moment of absolute clarity. I got it. I don't know what yet, I don't understand it properly, but I'm absolutely convinced this is the answer, right? I got it. I got the solution. I cracked the code. Now you got to develop it. You got to think about it. You got to process it. Right? I've got to understand it. We know the danger often is that when you start to understand it, you lose the kernel of truth. You lose the clarity, and you go into your own ways of thinking, and you become distorted, right? That's why there's a pasuk that says that when you go into the level of binah, you always have to hang on to the chokhmah. You always have to check it against the clarity of truth. So what chokhmah is clarity. Now in Kabbalah, oil is called chokhmah. Why is oil called chokhmah? Because oil doesn't mix with any other liquid, doesn't become tainted. In other words, oil generates light is clarity, and also oil is above everything else. And that's chokhmah. Chokhmah is that truth from the outside that is guiding me, which is remains aloof, remains detached. Right? So chokhmah is clarity. Bais, the house, is malchus. So here we've got a situation of malchus, behavior, implementation, action, becoming impure. When does action become impure? Action becomes impure when it's driven by ego, when it's distorted, when it's not guided by chokhmah. When you lose the clarity of chokhmah, you've forgotten why you're doing this, you don't check and anchor back into the clarity and spirituality and holiness of chokhmah, that's when your bias becomes messed up. Right? Two people can start doing the very, very same thing, and one can land up badly and one can do good. Because the one is checking with the chokhmah all the time to make sure that it's still in the right way, the other one's not, and therefore lands up with egocentricity and is distorted. Says the Mishnah, if impurity comes into a house, impurity is threatening a bias, you're engaged in an experience which is susceptible to impurity, it's susceptible to being distorted, it's susceptible to becoming damaged. If you wait there past the time it takes to light the candle, then you're in trouble. But if you always stay within the time it takes to light a candle, then you're safe. That's the deeper meaning of this mission. This was explained by Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, the father of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who used to write a lot of Kabbalistic notes on halachic literature. He had this knack of connecting. That's part one. However, it goes further than that. How does it go further? What candles are we talking about here? So according to the Mefarshim, the candle of the Torah that the Mishnah is talking about is the candles of Shabbos. Why? Simple thing. What's it based on, this example? It's based on this idea that the owner wasn't able to tell the guy to leave. He's busy lighting a candle. So he's busy lighting a candle, so he couldn't tell him to leave. Now he finished the candle, he can tell the guy to leave. In other words, right, so the example, you walk into someone's house, you can't immediately to leave because he's doing something. That's what the Mefarshim explained. So the Mefarshim asked, what do you mean? If he's lighting a candle, he can immediately tell the guy to leave. He's lighting a candle, but he can still say leave. The answer, no, because the example the Mishnah is talking about is Shabbos candles. So when a person is lighting Shabbos candles, he can't talk, you're doing the mitzvahs. Therefore, if he has to finish first, then he can tell the person to leave. Right? Anyway, that's just a halachic way of understanding that the example the Mishnah is giving, it's just an example, obviously. It's always that amount of time, but the example of the Mishnah gives actually Shabbos candles. Oh, if that's the case, now we have to take it further. We have to take it further and understand the direct connection, not just between the idea of clarity, idea of candle, idea of oil, and impurity, but let's now take the whole thing further and take it deeper. What are we talking about? Which impurity are we talking about? We're talking about tsaras, which comes as a result of lashon hara. What are we talking about? Which candle are we talking about that prevents the house from contracting that impurity? Shabbos candles. What's the connection between Shabbos candles and tsaras, and how do Shabbos candles protect the concept of tsaras? So on a very simple level, we know that Shabbos candles is connected with the idea of shalom bayit, peace, unity. If you look in Shulchan Aruch, if you look in Gemara, the whole mitzvah of Shabbos candles came about so that on Shabbos there should be peace and tranquility in the home. Right? The expression that's used in Gemara is that the rabbi said there has to be Shabbos candles. Don't forget, in those times there was no light, it was dark, right? People shouldn't stumble upon a piece of wood or a piece of stone. People will trip and then people get upset with each other, become irritated, people will fight. That's no good. So we say, no, a house must be lit Shabbos, so everyone should know where they're going, no one will knock into each other. And it'll be fine. Right? So that's the idea of Shabbos, kind of idea of peace. What's Lashon Hara? What's Tzaras? Tzaras is the whole concept of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is about creating division between people. Right? So therefore, we can understand on a very simple level, what's the antidote to Lashon Hara? The idea of Shabbos candles, which explains the Mishnah, that if someone walks into a bias, if the bias has tranquility, it's protected from what is the constant impurity of Tzaras, if not, not. But let's take it deeper than that. Okay, that's on a simple level. The expression, I just said, the expression about Shabbos candles is that there should be, people shouldn't stumble upon an eitz or an evan, a piece of wood or a stone. The question is asked, that's a funny expression if you think about it. We should say rather people shouldn't stumble on each other, they shouldn't knock into each other. What's the expression people shouldn't trip on a stone or anything? Why would that bring disunity? What does that mean? A trip may bring an injury, but why would that bring a stone or a piece of wood? Eitz for evan, right? That's what it says. Shelo yukashel ba'eitz evan, you shouldn't trip on a stone, on a piece of wood or a stone. So the deeper meaning behind all this is as follows. When we talk about unity and disunity, we're not just talking about between people. We're talking about the concept of oneness versus the concept of fragmentation, which we've talked about in previous times. It says the Torah, it says in Gemara, the Torah was given to bring peace to the world. What does that mean, to bring peace to the world? What does that mean? Why? Where's the politics that we need Torah to bring peace to the world? Between who and who? Right? The Torah says the Torah is shalom. Torah was given to bring peace in the world. Peace between who and who? Between what? Okay, but that's only part of the Torah is between man and man. Half the Torah is between man and God. So, right? The answer is no. Torah was given to bring peace between God and the world. What does that mean? Before Torah, God and the world are in conflict. If you look at the world seems like an independent entity which conceals God, which is against God, which does not reveal the oneness of God. Correct? Yeah.
God brought the world into being.
Correct, but if you don't have Torah, you don't see that. You might see it on an intellectual level, but you don't. Why do people turn, first of all, why was there pagan worship? Because people forgot the whole existence of God. On a more refined level, there's still pagan worship. Why do people worship materialism? There's a possible
God's presence?
Yeah. Because to them, it might be a God, and he might have even created the world, but that's not what you do with the world. In other words, the world is a separate thing. They look at the world, and they see the world as it seems superficially. Right? There's an amazing pasuk. The pasuk says when God, when Jeremiah the prophet, Yirmiyahu the prophet, let me find the exact expression of this pasuk. It's a beautiful pasuk. Yeah, there's a pasuk, and you'll see where I'm going with this pasuk in a second. In Yirmiyahu, when he was reprimanding the nation for turning towards pagan worship, right? So he said to them, Oimrim la'eitz avi'ata. People look at the wood and they say, you're my father. Ula'evan, they look at the stone and they say, Ati ladatani, you have given birth to me. Right? Now that can be in a literal sense, although they bow down to the stone thinking it actually gave birth to them. But it hasn't finished. Even though today people don't do pagan worship in that form, but they do. We all do, because we worship the stone and we worship the world. Why? Because we look at the world, we look at a stone, or it can be a precious stone sometimes. We look at a stone, or we look at a piece of wood, we look at something material, and we say, this is what it is. Its significance, its importance is what you see. Physicality. We divorce the world from God. That's the conflict that we need. Torah needs to bring to it, right? Now, Torah is called Torah Or. Torah brings light. Torah brings clarity. Specifically, Shabbos does this. This is the whole idea of Shabbos. We talked about this for the Shabbos project a lot. The whole idea of Shabbos is to bring the oneness into the world, to see God behind the world. And if you remember, we talked about the thought and the speech, right? The fragmentation versus the oneness, and so on and so forth. Right? This is the true meaning of what Chazal tell us, that you have to light Shabbos candles, that you shouldn't stumble over a stone or a piece of wood. Doesn't mean you shouldn't trip physically. I mean, you shouldn't make the mistake to misread the stone or the wood. Like Yirmiyahu Navi says, you shouldn't look at a stone and say, it's my father. Or a piece of wood and say, you gave birth to me. That's stumbling over a stone in Allah. Why? So you have to light Shabbos candles there. What does Shabbos candles represent? The clarity of Torah. When there's clarity of Torah, that the Torah gives us, you don't stumble over a stone in a thing because you see God in the stone. You give it superficial, exterior, less important, secondary importance, and rather use it for its true meaning and its true purpose, because you don't divorce the stone from God. You see it as a part of God's reality, so therefore you can use it out to serve God. You can use it out to make God's service better. Right? How can you do that? Only when you make peace between God and the world. How do you make peace between God and the world? The clarity of Shabbos candles, the clarity of Torah. The character of Torah shows that God and the world really are not divorced from each other, but that there's a divinity in the God, in the world, that you can use out. You can connect the world to God. What's tzaras? Tzaras is impurity. What does the impurity come from? The impurity comes from disunity between people. Where does this unity between people come from? The exact same thing. We are very different. We are all different. That's where our conflict comes from. We're not all different. Only all different superficially. When you look at the world superficially, there's a conflict between God and the world. There's a conflict between person and person. You create isolation. You create disunity between people. However, when we understand that we all have an neshama, yes, we all express it differently. But at the very core, we're all part of one reality. We're all created by God. We all have one purpose. We all have one mission. We all have one soul. How can you talk against another person? We're all part of one body. Can the right hand talk against the left hand? So that when the clarity of Torah brings oneness into the world, when you make peace between the world and God, automatically it must translate between peace between people. And vice versa. Which is why Hillel told the convert, right? Tanya says that Hillel told the convert, one of the whole Torah in one foot, he told him, don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. That's the whole Torah, the rest is commentary. So the obvious question is, what do you mean? That's not the whole Torah, that's half the Torah. Between man and man. Why the whole Torah? No, he says, no, it is the whole Torah. Because when you avas v'hafta rechmei, loving another person like yourself, comes from recognizing death, recognizing the soul. It comes from recognizing the deeper layer behind creation. If I understand the depth between of me and the depth of you, then we one. There's no room for disunity. If I recognize that, I recognize the depth of the whole world. There's no room for disunity between the world and God either. And therefore that brings all the mitzvahs. It brings a life of divine service. So therefore the Mishnah says, when you go into a house, when there's a bayis, when there's a world, and the world is filled of so many different things, and they're threatened by the impurity of disunity, we're threatened by looking at the house superficially and seeing each thing in its own right. The stone is a stone and the wood is a wood and everything's competing with each other and you only see the superficial and you're bowing down to the stone and the piece of wood. So if you stay within the Hadlaka Saner, if you stay within the Shabbos candles, which symbolize the clarity of holiness, the clarity that it's all one and it's all part of God's creation, then you won't be susceptible. That's the antidote to the disunity. But if you're out of the zone of candle lighting, then you're in trouble. Then you're susceptible to the impurity of disunity, which translates into the disunity of Tzaraas. And that's the deeper meaning of the Mishnah.
And that unity is Jew and non-Jew.